You're listening to VCJ, Victoria College Chat.
Forces. If there's a resultant force, then the effect of force is to change the motion of something. This is all described in Newton's three laws of motion, which you need to know. Law number one, an object will stay at the same velocity unless a resultant force is acting upon it. Now, of course, the same velocity means it can be staying still. And the same velocity also means it has to be going in the same direction, because you remember velocity is a vector, it includes direction. Newton's second law says that F equals ma, force is equal to mass times acceleration. And Newton's third law, which is far and away the most useless for anything to do with our GCSE, but is oddly the one that all of you remember, goodness knows why, is that every force has an equal and opposite reaction force. So then Newton's three laws, how do we apply them? Well, the important thing is F equals ma. The F in F equals ma has to be a resultant force. So if there are multiple forces acting on an object, then they've all got to be added together and subtracted until you find the final overall resultant force. If there's an engine driving and there's air resistance on a car, you've got to subtract the air resistance from the thrust of the car in order to work out the resultant. You can then divide by mass in order to work out acceleration. Remembering forces, if you're calculating a force, has a unit newtons, put down the capital N. Make sure it's a capital or be in trouble. Okay, so forces. All of the F equals ma stuff is hopefully pretty straightforward. There's some interesting things about not going in straight lines, cars going in circles, you going round roundabouts. All of that requires a force, even if you're going in a circle at the same speed. And that's very hard to get your head round. You imagine that if you're travelling at the same speed, there's no need for a force to be acting. But of course, if you're going in a circle, your direction is changing all of the time. And that means that there is a force acting, because your velocity is changing. Velocity includes direction. If direction is changing, velocity is changing. If velocity is changing, there is an acceleration. And if there is an acceleration, there has to be a resultant force. For something in a circle, we call that resultant force centripetal force. Never, ever, ever, ever say centrifugal force. It's a centripetal force, and it acts towards the centre of the circle that you're turning around. Not a lot more to know about it than that. If the circle is smaller, then the centripetal force needs to be higher. If the object is going round the circle faster, the centripetal force needs to be higher. If the mass of the object is higher, the centripetal force needs to be higher. So anything going in a circle, it's have an overall resultant force acting upon it. And that, of course, explains satellites. Satellites go in circles around the Earth. There has to be an overall resultant force acting upon them, and that overall resultant force is gravity, Earth's gravity. And if you happen to be in one of those satellites, i.e. if you happen to be a astronaut aboard the International Space Station, then you're going in the same circle. And that same circle is being created by gravity. So you and your spaceship are both going in exactly the same circle, both being created by the acceleration due to gravity. And the end result is, compared to the space station, there's no gravity. You're not weightless in that there is no gravity acting upon you. But it feels like you're weightless, because you and the spacecraft are both being accelerated by the Earth's gravity, but you're being accelerated into a circle. Gravity is providing the centripetal force for both of you, so that it feels like there is no weight acting for you compared to the spaceship. Tough one to get your head around. Hopefully they're not going to ask you any questions about that. If they ask you questions about centripetal force, all they're really going to want to know is smaller circle, larger force. And what provides that force? So we get questions about race cars going around corners. What's providing the centripetal force? Well, it's the friction between the tyres and the road. Make sure you write down the whole sentence, friction between the tyres and the road. Don't just write down friction. That's not guaranteed to get you the marks. A stone going round in a slingshot, what's providing the centripetal force? Well, it's the bit of rope making the slingshot. So think about what's providing the centripetal force. It is never a force by itself, it's always provided by something else. As I say, the usual example is the friction of tyres on the road getting a car or a motorbike to go round a corner. Centripetal force. So that's a bit of an aside, really. There's that, there's calculating the questions based on F equals ma, where you're working out the resultant force. And all of that's pretty straightforward. We then go on to the slightly more complicated things, which is where not where we're using forces to create motion, but where we've got forces balanced, but still having an effect. For the number one example that we've been using is, of course, hanging weights off a spring. We're applying a force to the spring, and the spring stretches. Now, once it reaches an equilibrium point, nothing carries on accelerating. So therefore there's no resultant force. The spring stretches to a point where the upward force, where the spring trying to pull itself back into shape, balances out the downward force due to the weight we're applying. But we get a change of shape. Now that change of shape for a spring is described by a thing called Hooke's law. And Hooke's law says that the extension of a spring is directly proportional to the applied force. Now, directly proportional, of course, you all remember, means a straight line that goes through zero. Or if I double one of the variables, the other variable doubles as well. Directly proportional. Hooke's law can be written as F equals kx. The force applied is equal to some constant known as the spring constant, or more often the stiffness of the spring, multiplied by the extension. F equals kx. And of course, the trouble is that Hooke's law doesn't hold for the entire way. You all remember that. You remember doing this experiment where eventually the spring fails because the end uncurls and the weight drops off onto your toes. So eventually we get to a point where the spring doesn't close back up again. And that point is the point where the straight line ceases to be straight. And therefore we call it the limit of proportionality. The point where the line stops being straight, the point where the line stops being proportional, the limit of proportionality, and that's a term that you have to know. Okay, there's not a whole lot more to that bit of forces, so from there we come on to the much tougher bit of forces, which is working out moments. So I'm going to play you some of the awful music before we get on to moments. Lucky, lucky you. Now that nonsense is called fun time, but I think it's anything but fun, so forgive me if I talk over the top of it. It'll slowly disappear and we'll forget about its existence. So we come on to moments and turning effects. Now of course if we've got a beam that's secured at one end by a pivot, then the pivot is going to lock it in place. We can't make it accelerate away, but we can make it turn. So the pivot is going to provide us with an opposing force, and therefore we're not going to be able to make the beam accelerate away linearly, but nevertheless we can make it turn. And that effect is called a moment. And we calculate a moment by multiplying the force by the perpendicular distance from the force to the pivot. And what do I mean by perpendicular distance? Well, if you imagine drawing a line in the direction of the force, which of course you've got to be able to do because force is a vector, draw a line in the direction of the force, then at some point along that line you can draw in another line at 90 degrees that runs back to the pivot. And it's that distance between the pivot and the force, but drawn at 90 degrees to the direction of the force that we use to calculate moments. Why is that important? Well, that's important because forces at different angles can produce different moments, even if they're all actually acting on the beam at exactly the same distance away, because it's not the total, it's not the absolute distance, it's the perpendicular distance that you have to measure. Okay, so moments, we multiply the force by the perpendicular distance back to the pivot, and that allows us to calculate a moment. Now, if moments are unbalanced, then things will spin round, round, round. But very rarely are you asked to do anything to do with moments being unbalanced. Normally, moments are balanced. And for that to be true, all of the moments that are acting to turn our beam clockwise must be matched by moments that are acting to turn our beam anticlockwise. In other words, the sum of the clockwise moments equals the sum of the anticlockwise moments. Now, that's quite hard to say quite fast. The sum of the clockwise moments is... Oh, see, I told you it was hard to say. The sum of the clockwise moments must equal the sum of the anticlockwise moments. It's dead easy when you say it slowly. How do we do the calculations? Well, it's pretty straightforward, actually. All you do is you identify which are the clockwise moments. You do your calculations. You put those on one side of your equation. You identify what are the anticlockwise moments. You write those down, and you put those on the other side of your equation. Your two equations, your two expressions must balance up. They must be equal to each other. So you can put an equal sign in the middle. And then one of those things in there will be an unknown. There's something in there that you will not know, and you'll need to rearrange the equation in order to find it. Hopefully now, year 11, all of your maths is good enough to do that rearrange. I'm disappointed in you if your maths isn't good enough to do that. It's a pretty simple rearrange to find one of the distances for one of the forces, or to find one of the forces, or something. Now, how does it get made complicated? Well, you know how the exam board like to make it complicated. They like to give you examples drawn on rulers. Just like the meter rulers that we use when we do this as an experiment in our lab, they give you exactly the same experiments drawn on meter rulers with weights attached to these meter rulers creating forces. But, and this is the big issue, they give you the distance along the ruler. Why does that matter? Matters because the distance you care about is the distance from the pivot. So you have to, before you start anything else, draw on the diagram all the distances from the pivot. The distances along the ruler aren't important. The distances from the pivot are the important things. They're the only things you can use for your moments calculation. So you have to, you absolutely have to make sure that you put them into this into that equation. Draw them on the diagrams, use them in your equations, but beware, what have they actually asked you for in the question? Have they asked you for a distance, if it's a distance you're calculating rather than a force, have they asked you for the distance away from the pivot, or have they asked you how far along the ruler it is? You're going to have calculated the distance from the pivot. Make sure that if that's not what they've asked for, you convert it into distance along the ruler. And of course, don't forget to put centimetres on the end. What are the units for moments? Well, of course, what have we done? We've multiplied a force by a distance, and therefore the units are the units you'd expect from force times distance. They are Newton metres, or quite often Newton centimetres. Makes no difference which of the two you work in. You can work in metres, or you can work in centimetres, or you can work in millimetres. It'd be a long beam for you to be working in kilometres. But when you write the unit down, make sure you write down the correct unit for whichever one you've used. Newton centimetres is fairly typical in the IGCSE because of this use of metre ruler examples. So, Newton centimetres. Nothing in between them, just a capital N, little c, little m, Newton centimetres. Or be clever, work in metres. I think that's the better way to do it. That's what you'd be expected to do at A level. But at IGCSE, they don't mind, so long as you make it clear which one you are using. Okay, anything else that you need to know? You need to be able to describe an experiment to do it. Well, we've done these experiments, so I'm sure you can describe an experiment to find moments. Now, there is a little wrinkle, however. The pivot has to be providing a force, doesn't it? I hope you've all gone, yes, Dr. Cook, the pivot has to be providing a force, because otherwise the whole beam would be moving somewhere. The pivot's got to be providing a force. And so sometimes you get questions that ask you to work out what the force the pivot is providing is. And you think, oh, how can I do that? I can't use moments to do that. No, you can't use moments to do that, because, of course, there's no distance to the pivot, and so the force would be multiplied by zero, so it would be nonsense. You don't use moments to do that. You just add the forces up. Because if the beam isn't going anywhere, all the upward forces have to equal all the downward forces. It's in equilibrium. All of the upward forces have to equal all the downward forces. So add up the downward forces along your beam, subtract any upward forces there might be, and then whatever's left over has to be the upward force being created by the pivot. Because those forces all have to add up to zero, including the force being created by the pivot. So sometimes that question turns up. It's not difficult. It's just the total upward forces have to equal the total downward forces because it's in equilibrium, just the same way the total anti-clockwise moments have to equal the total clockwise moments because it's in equilibrium. And the total sideways forces have to equal the total sideways forces going the other way because it's in equilibrium. But very rarely when we're doing moments do we worry about sideways forces.
You're listening to VCJ. Victoria College, Jersey.
Equilibrium is actually an important one because you have to be able to define equilibrium. Well, that's fairly easy. All the forces are in balance and all the moments are in balance. There's no resultant force, there's no resultant moment. But you also need to be able to do scale diagrams to work out equilibrium. And that's much more difficult. You don't seem to like that one. Now, because force is a vector, forces at angles have to be added up, either using trigonometry or using scale diagrams. Now, for the IGCSE, you're not required to do the trigonometry. You'll have to do that for A-level. But you are required to be able to use the scale diagrams. Now, the way you draw a scale diagram with adding up forces is you place the force arrows acting in the correct directions and of the correct lengths, so that they're this length scales to the size of the force, you place them so that the arrows follow round. So that one arrow points into the next arrow, points into the next arrow. That's how you add up forces. That's vector addition. You add up forces by placing the arrows so that one arrow follows into the next arrow, follows into the next arrow. And if adding up the two forces is all that you've been asked to do, then you stop there. The resultant force for the two of them is just the gap between the start and the end of your two forces. You measure how long that gap is, that tells you how long the resultant is, and if you happen to have drawn your arrows in exactly the right orientation, then it'll also tell you the direction that your resultant force is acting in. So if all you've been asked to do is add up two forces and find their resultant, you draw the two vectors, one leading into the other, arrows following on. You then just join up the gap, start at your first, at the bottom of your first one, end at the final arrow of your second one, and that will give you the resultant, which, as I say, you measure, you find your scale, you work out how big the force is. So adding them up is pretty easy. However, if you have to do something more complicated and talk about equilibrium, now, something that is in equilibrium, all of those arrows must add up to zero. There's no overall resultant force. They've got to add up to zero. To add up to zero in a vector diagram, in a vector scale diagram, adding up to zero means they come back to where they started. So if you place all of the correctly drawn scaled force arrows one after another, they'll actually make a closed shape, usually a triangle, because it's usually only three forces that you've got to think about. So they'll actually come back to the beginning and make a closed triangle. And very often what they do is they give you two of the forces, they tell you it's in equilibrium, they ask you to find the third force. Now you do that by drawing your scale diagram, placing the two forces, one arrow pointing into the next arrow, even if they don't on the original diagram. Don't worry about it. It's not about the original diagram. You're adding up vectors. So you place them so that one arrow follows onto the next arrow, and then you draw in a final arrow that brings you back to where you started, And that final arrow that brings you back to where you started is the missing force. And you can therefore work out how strong that force is and what direction that force has from looking at your scale diagram. Quite difficult to describe, much easier to show you how to do it on a board, but this is a podcast, so I'm doing it by a description. My apologies that it's quite hard to follow. Now this song is also from the FreePlay website, but isn't by FreePlay themselves, it's actually by somebody who's written it and uploaded it, a chap called Adam Michaels, and I think you'll agree it's a hell of a lot better. But on the other hand, it is getting a bit tedious now, 3 minutes in, so I'm fading it away so I can keep on talking. What have I got to talk about now? Let me see. I am on... Oh dear. I'm on centre of mass. Centre of mass is another equilibrium problem, really. The centre of mass is where you can think of all of the mass of an object as being concentrated. It's effectively where we draw the force arrow for weight as from. So it's where we can think of gravity as acting within a body. Centre of mass. How do you find centre of masses? Well, that's easy enough. We've done the experiment, if you remember. All we do is we draw... vertical lines on hanging shapes, hang them in a few different places, and where those vertical lines cross must be the centre of mass. Now you've got to be able to describe the reason for that. The reason why is because the centre of mass hangs directly below, because it's only at that point when everything is in equilibrium. If the centre of mass is off to one side of the pivot, then the weight acting through the centre of mass is at a perpendicular distance away from the pivot, and so is therefore creating a moment. That moment turns it around so that the centre of mass is then under the pivot. Okay? So it's not in equilibrium if the centre of mass isn't directly underneath the pivot point when it's freely hanging. So you remember doing the experiment with the funny shapes, you know, there's a train and a man and we stuck holes in them and hung them and drew lines on. All nice and easy. The only other things about centre of mass is you have to remember that the position of the centre of mass affects something's stability. Something is more stable if its centre of mass is lower, and something is more stable if its base is wider. The reason being that it's then harder to move the centre of mass outside of the base, which would create a moment that kept it turning. Once the centre of mass moves outside of its base, it then creates a moment which keeps the object turning. When the centre of mass is inside the object's base, it creates a moment that turns it back, brings it back to the equilibrium position. So, better if centres of mass are lower and if there is a wider base. And that's forces done. The formulas, if you remember, were F equals ma from Newton's second law, F equals kx from Hooke's law, and moment is equal to force multiplied by perpendicular distance. Right, we'll pick this up with the next podcast about energy.